Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
All right, well, welcome to this episode of the Learning Well podcast. This is actually part two of our game discussion. We've had such a great conversation that we split them into two, and today we're going to talk about black hat motivation. I have the same group of people sitting around the table. So I have Cade and Austin, Eric, Nathan, Andrea, and producer Jeff. That's right. So let's jump right in and take a look at black hat motivation. Which, again, as a reminder, is more of those negative type motivators that we try to use a little more sparingly in learning design. But a lot of games have quite a bit of black hat motivation built in. So the first one is ownership and possession. And Cade, you're sort of our resident tabletop board game, whatever person. So talk to us about ownership and possession.
Yeah, this idea, ownership and possession, is actually really fascinating to me. Because there are a lot of games that do it, but there are very few that actually do it well. And so this is, at the core of this idea of gaining something, protecting it, and almost creating a sense of identity around that possession. And so when I was kind of thinking through my catalog of games, what do I want to talk about? This game called Blood Rage came to my mind.
Sounds angry.
It is.
And so bloody.
The theme is it's in Nordic mythology, and it's Ragnarok has happened, and you have a clan of Vikings, and you are trying to basically achieve glory, whether through life or death. And there's this game mechanic that a lot of games have called area control, territory control. It's probably really popular in video games too, maybe.
Risk.
Yeah,
it's an oldie, but
yeah. And so this game has this really, really interesting balance of wanting to gain these different territories, keep possession of those territories, but then also expanding out and taking control of other territories. But there's this element to it that some games also have of, like, once you gain that territory, there's like a tend your own garden. And so this game really creates this feeling of like, I own this now, I need to possess this. But a lot of the times it's not actually beneficial for you to actually keep that territory. Maybe beneficial for you to extract the different resources or different power from that and go and try to take over another territory. Huh. But there's this thematic piece that you become so entrenched in your clan and you have this alliance with a god that you dive so deep, and I'm a sucker for theme.
Right.
And so
clearly we can tell from your excitement.
Yeah, I'm like, I sit into my region and I'm like, well, no, this god wouldn't do this, right? This god would do this, and I'm gonna keep my territory. And so this idea of keeping everything that I've gained within my possession is very, like, intrinsically motivating to me as a player, but it's not actually what's in the best interest of me achieving glory and winning the game itself. And so, like I mentioned, theme is a big piece of that. There's a drafting mechanic in the game. And so there is this a little bit of randomness that you're interacting with other players. And so as a player, I can also create this environment and ecosystem for myself that hurts other players. So in some instances, I can actually do something that doesn't necessarily benefit me winning. It protects me by giving other players cards in this drafting mechanic.
Huh.
Whereas I could actually draft a card that would be better for me to win, but because of this black hat motivator of not necessarily thinking of winning, I don't want to give something up.
Yeah, interesting.
So it has that really, really interesting piece of mechanic to it that I love. And I have yet to achieve the ultimate glory in this game.
Oh, no.
So
you're clearly entrenched in the ownership piece.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, there's a lot of the MMO games and things that have that similar sense of areas, or and we don't have to go into that, but ownership and possession is a huge motivator in a lot of games. And that's one thing, like we talked about at the beginning of this, people are motivated by different things. So most games have more than one motivating factor. Obviously, you can't have like all 8 or it wouldn't work, but they usually have more than one. And this is a pretty popular one. Yes.
The one thing I do want to mention about this is really, I am always challenged with, is that this black hat motivator really almost forces you to double down the deeper you get into aligning yourself with this motivation. So you could get halfway through the game and you've entrench yourself so deeply in a strategy that's based on this black hat motivation of ownership that you can't actually back yourself out. Huh. You just have to keep doubling down and right. hope it pays out.
Right.
And it so often does not pay out.
Clearly. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and I was thinking of a super quick illustration. Like one thing that I do like to play, I play cards a lot, and there's a specific version of Rummy where like at a certain point, you know somebody's going to go out. And so you just got to start, you know you're not going to win. So you just got to throw away all your high cards. But like if you have that sense of ownership, you're like, no, these are my cards and I want to keep going to win. You're just in trouble. Like you're going to lose for sure. You just got to throw it all away.
Yep.
But well, so there's two other black hat motivators that kind of go together. And those are scarcity and impatience and then unpredictability and curiosity. And so, Eric, I know you want to talk about Clash Royale, but we have some other other games that fit into that. Nathan and Austin, you wanted to talk about. So explain to us scarcity and patience and then a little bit of the unpredictability and curiosity and how those come out in these games.
Yeah, I'm actually going to start with unpredictability and curiosity because I think it kind of leads into the scarcity as well. So in Clash Royale, there are 106 cards you can choose from, and you pick 8. As your playing deck. And it's a player versus player game. So every game that I play, I don't know which 8 cards of the 106 my opponent is gonna use. So that unpredictability is something that's really interesting to me. And I like that I have to kind of prepare for, you know, all situations because you never know whether they're gonna come at you with like a bridge spam deck or kind of a beatdown, as they would call it in the kind of the Clash Royale universe. So that variety and unpredictability really like attracts me to the game because I wouldn't want to play the same opponents every time that play the same cards. And it ties into the scarcity and impatience bit a little bit because when you win, you win a treasure chest, and the cards that you would get from the treasure chest are unpredictable. It's kind of like a loot box.
It could be great, but they could be terrible.
They could be terrible. They're often terrible. because of that slim chance that they're great,
you want to keep playing. Yeah.
And so that loot box dynamic is something that Nathan, I'm sure, can really dive into.
But that's where our whole ethics conversation comes in. Too. So, but let's talk about, you know, scarcity and impatience a little bit and curiosity as it relates to those things.
Absolutely. So scarcity and impatience, it kind of ties in with the ownership. Something is really hard to get and it might be really valuable. It might also just be really valuable because it's really hard to get. So people want that sort of thing. So
supply and demand.
Exactly. Okay. So people will put in an awful lot of work to get it. There is a player market driven system where players are able to take all the items that they have collected, put them for sale, and other players can buy them. And what you see is a really heavy example of supply and demand. The items that are super hard to get, where you have to defeat really strong bosses for, they don't drop very frequently. It's really hard to get these things. People will put those up on the marketplace and they sell for millions of in-game currency.
And is that stuff you're actually in-game currency, something you've earned, or are people really playing money there? They're real money into it.
For these particular items, you are only using in-game currency.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's a really good segue into the loot system and the gacha system, which I think someone correct me if I'm wrong, but gacha is just another word for loot box. Like they're essentially the same thing.
Keep going. We're going. Yes, that sounds good.
So New Genesis also has a system where you can spend real money to get a chance to get like an item that you might really want. The way that it works, and this is kind of just a description of loot boxes in general. And loot boxes are actually what I wrote that ethics paper on that I mentioned earlier. Because it's a very controversial system that video games have been implementing. They use the two black hat motivators of scarcity and unpredictability to get people to spend absurd amounts of money in the game.
And this is real currency in that case.
Yes, this is real currency. One of the other games that I used to play a lot, it was a phone game called Final Fantasy Brave Exvius. The way that the loot boxes work in that game is you spend like maybe $20 and you get 10 in-game characters. And it's completely random what those characters are. Most of the time, they're really low-level characters that no one's interested in. But every once in a while, you can get that really good character that you really want. But the acquisition rate is like 0.01% for some of them, or sometimes it's even lower. It's ridiculous. But what that causes to do is, because these characters are really hard to get and you don't know what you're going to do, so you have the scarcity and unpredictability, people will throw absurd amounts of money in this game. Some countries, like, I remember Belgium, back when I was writing this ethics paper, had just outlawed Brave Exvius.
Because it's considered gambling? Or like what?
Exactly. It is gambling. The interesting thing is these loot boxes that like different games will implement, they don't actually give you a competitive advantage in-game. It's mostly like cosmetic items that make your characters look pretty, or just something that you really want. But I remember reading a couple stories where one guy spent like $6,000 trying to get one specific character, and he didn't even get it. But eventually he just ran out of money. He's like, I can't continue to fund this anymore.
Well, these are powerful motivators, clearly. And then there are ethical issues related to this then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of controversy where like minors play these games. How do we handle putting loot systems in when minors are involved? And, you know, kids have gone and stolen their parents' credit cards before so they can, do more loot boxes so they can try and get what they really want.
Yeah. And a lot of these systems are set up too. I know, from my experience with my children, where you have a credit card attached anyway because you downloaded, and that happened to our family one time, and it wasn't, nobody was stealing anything. It was just attached to it. And with minors, my son was really young. He didn't realize he was spending real money. He thought it was like you said, in-game currency. So there's a whole side to this that is very interesting, and I think a much larger question. But Eric, you had something, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, like, for that one example, the loot that they were gambling on was, like, wouldn't affect the game at all. Versus, like, in Clash Royale, it was something they would call it pay to win. Mm-hmm. So if you spend more money, you're going to eventually get better things, better cards, and you're going to play better. You're going to have an advantage over the players that are free to play or don't spend in-game currency. But it's really interesting when you look into like the loot box dynamic, where it kind of pops up, because it's also in Pokemon Go with the egg incubators. So you can walk 5 kilometers to hatch an egg, but if you spend real money on a super incubator, maybe you only have to walk 2.5 kilometers. Or with the raids that Andrea talked about, if you want to join a raid that's not where you're physically present, so for example, I've joined a raid in Japan before, and I've never been to Japan, you can pay real money to get a remote pass to play in that raid. However, a lot of people will do that hoping to get a special shiny like raid Pokemon, which you only have a 1 in 20 shot of getting. So I know people who have spent money on, 60 remote raid passes and never gotten their shiny whatever Pokemon it was.
At that rate, it'd almost be cheaper to just fly to Japan.
Right.
Exactly.
There's in board gaming universe, there's a term, it's just like a press your luck mechanic.
Yeah,
In board games, tabletop, it's a lot lower stakes than what you guys are talking about. But one game that a lot of people would be familiar with is King of Tokyo, and you just have monsters, and as a monster, you can go into the city of Tokyo, and you're basically just going to be thematically smashing buildings while everybody's attacking you, because everybody else wants to get into Tokyo, because that's how you gain points. But while you're in there, it's just a cost-benefit analysis that you're constantly having to do. And not knowing what the game that you guys are talking about just makes me think about how this motivator is a cost-benefit analysis that's constantly occurring. But there's always that sliver. It's the same reason people buy Lotto too, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to eventually, hopefully, hit this, right? And so that happens. It's just in board gaming universe. It's called press your luck. And it happens. Games like that can often be really, really frustrating too.
Yeah.
You press your luck, and then you don't hit, and you're out.
Right.
Bummer. Game over, right?
Right.
And maybe somebody else presses their luck, and they get it every single time kind of thing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that also ties into the social influence part of it too, because when people are rolling these loot boxes and they get that item that they really want, you will see it plastered all over social media of, look, I finally got this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Real quick, Cade, there's another board game called Push, which if they expanded the name, it would be called Push Your Luck. It's just a card game, and that's the whole point, is just keep drawing cards, push your luck, and eventually you're going to get something where you lose all your points, and the points that you've drawn go to the other players. So it's like, when do you call it quits?
Yeah. All right, so our last Black Hat motivator is loss and avoidance. So, again, by the name, the idea here is avoiding pain. Now, it depends on what you define as pain, obviously, and how that motivates you or doesn't motivate you. We've kind of already hit on this with some other motivators, but like we've said, they all sort of, at a certain point, overlap a little bit, and games kind of pull in different ones of these motivators. But Austin, in particular, I know you talked about Dungeons & Dragons, the creation of your character. How does that apply to loss and avoidance?
Yeah, so with Dungeons & Dragons, you spend, depending on how much time you've already put in, but it works. Dungeons & Dragons works really well when everybody at the table's invested into telling stories. So you spend all this time investing in this character, and then you come to this challenge, whether it's the dragon or saving somebody, and you put your character, like their life at, like the stakes is your character's life and everything that you as the individual have invested in. So that includes time, and character development. So like if you really get attached to this character, and maybe the story they're telling, or you're telling with this character, like to put them up as a possible loss, where your story's just over.
Right.
You get the big the end moment for your character, and that doesn't get resolved, so you're kind of always stuck with that cliffhanger. So you have this pain of wanting to not lose the investment you've already brought to this character, as well as there's like actual in-game objectives. Like you don't want to, like to the character you're believing that they're saving somebody, you don't want that fictitious person to die or not get what they need. So you kind of like your heroism is tested as a character. As well as like you're the real game pain, the real life pain of like when a group of adults sit down and stay at a table telling stories together for 4 hours over however many months or years, depending on how long they've been playing. Like if your character dies, that's a whole lot of time that's just gone. And you have like the memories, but it's like that character no longer gets to move forward.
Yeah, you shared that and you're playing with adults. Like how they will avoid that at all costs at some point so they don't have to get rid of their character.
Yeah, people get really invested. Like I said, that's when it works best, is when they actually are kind of a little bit hesitant to put their character forward, because everyone knows it's a game and they're pretending. Like, so you're not like, oh, I might get actually hurt, but no, you might lose the investment is kind of what's going in your brain here. It's like the pain of loss. Fictitiously, as you jump into battle or try to save somebody's life, you're like, oh. But those are the moments I think where people come back to and they talk for years on end. Because like I remember, like I took a huge risk back when I was like 15. I put my character's life to jump off a cliff and do something epic and cool. We were running from I think giant, so I needed to put some distance between me and the giant. And I jumped off this cliff and I did a roll with the dice to predict what happened, and I lost the roll ended poorly. I don't know if it was quite a one, but I just didn't do enough to succeed. And I lost the special item that everyone was relying on me to caretake.
So
I put the whole game campaign like was lost in a sense
because of
a failure I had. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And this is almost to a certain degree, a little bit of opposite from what we talked about a few minutes ago, which is like the, taking the risk to press your luck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's the other thing too. And some of it I think is very much, personality driven too. Like, am I more like risk adverse, or am I more willing to press my luck? And that plays out in almost all games.
Yeah,
I think it absolutely too has to do with the consequences of what happens if you fail.
Yeah.
Like we were chatting before, the whole Souls trilogy, which is a series of video games. It's Demon Souls, Dark Souls, Bloodborne. I think Elden Ring falls into that line now. That entire franchise operates on loss and avoidance. The way that it works is you are a brand new squishy character who doesn't know what's going on in a world full of really big bad monsters. And for the most part, it's really difficult to just jump in and beat the monsters up. The entire game, you basically learn by dying over and over and over.
Right.
You
go failure. Up, learning by through failure.
Exactly. So you go up against this big monster, you have no idea how they work, you have no idea what they do, and they usually clobber you several times.
Mm-hmm.
The difficult part becomes the more that you play this game and you defeat the weaker enemies, you get like this in-game currency again. The problem is that you can accumulate a lot of this currency, but you can't spend it right away. You have to get to a certain checkpoint in order to spend it. Problem is, if you die before you get to that checkpoint, all of that currency just all of a sudden just sits on the ground. Hmm. And what happens is when your character respawns, you have to try and run back there and get that currency.
Okay.
If you die a second time before you grab it, it's all gone.
Huh.
And so, like, when you get pitted up against a area that's really hard to get through, like, you get all the way to the end, you're like, oh man, I can't believe I made it. And then all of a sudden, like, a random boulder just falls and kills you.
Gosh.
You're like, I have to do all of that again. I barely made it through the first time. I have to do all that again to try and get this currency. Otherwise, it's gone forever. And that hurts so much.
And you have one try.
Right.
You do. Yeah. And it's so that whole franchise has so much stress behind it. But that's also like a huge motivator because people really like the whole, I did it. I made it through this really tough thing and I didn't lose anything. It was awesome.
Yeah, that ties the black hat motivator right back into the development and accomplishment.
The white hat,
that we talked about earlier. I think that's really interesting.
Well, and I think too, like, even at just a very simple level, not even sort of the gaming part of things, although if you do think of it as gamification, you know, I'm doing this cycling program in an in-home bike program, and they have badges that you earn, and you earn a check mark every day you do a workout. It doesn't matter if the workout's 5 minutes, it doesn't matter if it's an hour, you still get that check mark. So I've had a check mark every single day since my birthday, which is about the past 5 months. But I forgot to do a quick meditation one day, because they have these meditation workouts you can do, and I woke up the next morning and I don't have the check mark. And so I have this whole thing, and it's such like that loss, like that fear of loss, like I forgot about it. But if you can think about it as a motivator, not getting that check mark will keep you going. And so that element of that is super motivating to keep people continuing to, in this case, you know, ride a bike or play a game or whatever.
So say Snapchat implemented that a lot.
Oh, for sure.
When it first started,
it
was all about front streaks and how long daily you would continue on your street.
My kids are freaking out. I'm like, it is not the end of the world.
I remember,
like,
people
would
go on vacation and they tell someone to take their phone to keep a streak up because they wouldn't be able to, like, they were like in the hundreds of days in a row, but just a funny motivator.
Yeah, same with like Duolingo and language learning. But sometimes the loss is too much. Like, for me, I made it 70 days in a row learning Swedish.
Oh, okay.
And the one day I missed, I have not picked up the app again
since
then.
It was so defeating.
I was trying to figure out a way to, like, reset my settings so I could put my time in a different time zone, because I actually did the work.
Right.
I just didn't. It didn't log it, like, you know, so.
So I have that struggle with my Bible app that I read, because it'll tell you, like, how many days in a row that you have read. The challenge that I find is that I will read that Bible app every single day. However, if I don't read it before midnight every single day.
Oh, it clicks over.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of nights where, like, some nights I'll read at 10:30, some nights I don't get to it until, like, 12:15.
Right.
And so I used to have, like, a really strong streak back when I had, like, a pretty good bedtime procedure. And now that that's out the window, I have never had a streak more than, like, 2 days, because I always read it after midnight.
Oh,
so it's like, this doesn't count.
Well, and everything that you all are saying kind of ties into sort of the way that we want to conclude this, which is, we've talked about all these motivators within games, and maybe there's not a direct application to our listeners with, like, learning and development. They might not be. Some of us are developing true games, which is what we're talking about. But what we really wanted to do is kind of provide some of this inspiration for any kind of digital learning that you're working on. And what you all are talking about is kind of the point we made at the beginning. If there's too much black hat motivation in anything, at a certain point, like you said, the loss is just too much and I just quit, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the white hat motivators keep us motivated because there's a different kind of motivation behind it. And I guess what I want to encourage our listeners at the end here is that, no, honestly, this is motivation. We're talking about in the context of games or gamification, but really it's motivation. And so if you can take even a small piece from what we've talked about and embed it in your, you know, any digital learning you're working on, so it could be an animation, it could be an e-learning, it could be an AR, it could be some micro-learning, but could you put one unexpected thing, you know, in your e-learning module? Or could you create some sort of sense of fear of missing out? Can you introduce scarcity or loss and avoidance in, like, a virtual ILT session? So I've seen that done. We've done that ourselves with, like, a pop-up quiz or a poll, and people don't want to miss out, and, like, they have to do it fast enough to answer the question or they've missed out. Or development accomplishment is obviously huge, but can you be more intentional? You know, if you're creating like micro learning modules, can you create a path where people are feeling accomplished because they get a credential at the end? So these are just kind of off the top of my head thoughts. But I'm hopeful our listeners can take what we've said and just kind of think through, get some inspiration for any type of digital learning that we're working on now. And before we wrap this up, I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that and kind of how you apply what we've talked about to the world that we live in all the time.
I think with what I was thinking about this as far as like the development and accomplishment goes, I mean, a lot of times we do, you know, we infuse gamification into our specifically our e-learning experiences. But when I think about, you know, the game that I talked about, which was Pokemon Go, the layers that all roll up to one another, mm-hmm. to me, thinking about that element within e-learning in that kind of sense to make it a bit more complex. So that you're meeting these mini goals, and that rolls up into this other goal, which impacts this other goal. It's a lot more complex, but the ultimate feeling of accomplishing those small goals to get the larger goal was super motivating, and I think that would keep learners more motivated as well.
Well, and what you're talking about is so we almost always, when we think of motivation or a game, it's always about starting. Like, we always talk about engaging people and making them excited to start. What we hardly ever talk about is motivating them to continue halfway through, and they're just want to poke your eyes out because you're just done with it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what you're saying. Like, these mini goals are motivating me to continue and to keep going. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I love that. Goal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any other thoughts, just as you think about the digital learning that you're making and how we might apply some of this in that? If you're good, you're good.
Nope.
All right, so I'm just going to wrap up instead, Jeff, and we'll cut that part out when I ask everybody else. Those are some really great thoughts, Andrea. And again, I just we're so happy to have our listeners along for the journey here, and the goal with this podcast was just to have some fun. You can see we're passionate about these things. I do believe in the show notes we'd agreed maybe to share our Pokemon Go.
Yeah, our friend codes.
I think we can do that. Good. All right, well, one of my favorite segments, and I think it's going to be especially interesting with all of you after these great conversations, we like to ask, what are you learning well now? And just again, a play on words with the name of the podcast, but our listeners are curious. I'm curious. So, Cade, why don't you tell us, what are you learning well now?
Yeah, so I love to read every night before bed. I try to spend like an hour to an hour and a half, and I try to split it between nonfiction and fiction.
I like that. That's a great idea.
And so one of the things that I'm doing is, because I'm not actually, I have a hard time reading fiction, and so I'm spending time just building my ability to think through fiction and feel connected to that. So I'm reading some Horowitz novels.
Yeah, we've talked about that. Yep, we love those.
Murder mysteries.
Yep.
But then the nonfiction that I'm reading is called Enlightenment Now by Steve Pinker. And he basically goes through these topics that are just very common conversation on wealth, inequality, terrorism, safety, just all the topics that so many people talk about. And just really gives different insight into those conversations. And really, I think, gets to the cause and roots of these different things, and provides just information that's maybe not always available readily.
Deeper
available.
Than the sound bites we always
hear. Yeah, it's more than just the sound bite. And I love it because it's just so, in so many ways, apolitical. And he just really gets into the data and information. So that's what I'm learning right now.
Well, we can put those, we'll put that book in the show notes. I think that would be helpful. Well, I love Cade's book suggestions. He and I have great conversations. We actually have an internal Slack channel where we share book ideas. But Austin, why don't you tell us, what are you learning well now?
Yeah, what I'm learning well now would be how to tell better stories, and in the framework of Dungeons and Dragons, because that's where I like to tell my stories. And then also how to change game mechanics on the fly for when your players are like going through something and it's not quite working, how to like change things without them realizing what's going on, so that they don't lose their, like, they don't, like, the, you don't show the wizard behind the curtain, you just let the wizard work.
Okay.
In a sense, and I mean, I'm like a tie to like Wizard of Oz. They're not like, don't look at the man behind the curtain. So like, when I'm behind changing rules on the fly, they're not like, hey, you just like mess with that monster's hit points, and now it's not as fun. Like, you don't want to let them know what you're doing, so that they're still maintaining their investment level in the game.
So in terms, so this is you're trying to learn how to be a better dungeon master.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Because you still play, right?
Yeah, I play. Yeah. try to do at least once a month, okay. but it's hard to get six or seven adults together right. on a schedule.
Right.
And so I learned those things, I guess, through different podcasts or rereading rule sets that are in published Dungeons & Dragons stuff. But a podcast that I listen to on the regular would be it's Matthew Colville. He's got a history in game development. Like, he's worked for professional gaming studios, and he writes fiction, and he just kind of lays out his whole experience creating professional games and also playing Dungeons & Dragons with his friends and, like, introducing things that they all can be excited about, and then redirect. If it doesn't work, he changes and does something else. So
that's great. So that's a real, actual, like, game application, and I love that you're listening and you're kind of getting it from a variety of ways, which is mm-hmm. really interesting. Eric, what about you? What are you learning well now?
I am learning about plants and gardening and landscaping, and specifically, like, native plants. The importance of growing things that are native to your area cannot be understated. You can go to a field that's all invasive species and cup your ears and listen and hear nothing.
Right.
And you go to a same similar size field of native plants, and it's just literally a buzz with insects and birds and wildlife.
Interesting.
So I've been learning about that all different ways on podcasts. Like, there's a Joe Gardner podcast is really good. YouTube, I really enjoy Canadian Permaculture Legacy. TV and streaming, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Monty Don, but he's a British gardener who does Gardener's World every week, and also did a little Netflix series called Big Dreams, Small Spaces. So even if you have a little, like, 20 by 20 yard or smaller, there are things that you can do kind of to fill that space. There's books. I have a really great one that's all landscaping with food. So vegetables.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
We're rolling into lunch here.
Vegetables, produce, herbs, those kind of things. And then, of course, on the internet, just random blogs and, like, Reddit, native plant gardening, no lawns, because, you know, your grass is not a crop.
That's
right. I'll end it there.
You have strong opinions, and I appreciate that.
I do.
I will get back with you, Eric. We'll add those, all the resources that people are sharing, we'll add those in the show notes.
Okay.
So, Nathan, what about you? What are you learning well now?
I just found a new computer software yesterday that was solving a big problem I had. So, it was the other night. I do a lot of, like, all my deep thinking in the shower. There's no stimulation.
Right, you have three children. I get it. That's probably your only... Yes.
That is very true. So that's the one time I'm like, there's nothing going on. I can just think. So I had all these ideas about a problem that Kate and I have been trying to tackle together. And so I ended up making, like, I had all these sticky notes just splattered all over my desk in the basement. And I'm like, okay, I have all these thoughts. I've organized them to all these sticky notes. I have to relay this information to Cade somehow.
And so, not just snap a picture.
Exactly. That would not have worked. So I found this new program online. It's called Lucid Spark. I used to use their old program, Lucid Chart, back when I was in grad school to do, like, process mapping and whatnot. And I thought, like, oh, maybe I could do that. So, like, I logged on to Lucid Chart, and they're like, hey, the thing you're doing, you should actually use Lucid Spark instead. And so I tried that out, and it was a really good way to... it's kind of like an online whiteboarding program.
Okay.
So they even have
that's
sticky
really
notes.
Helpful. Yeah.
Exactly. So I made a bunch... I replicated all my sticky notes onto this Lucid Spark sticky note board, and I was able to put, like, you know, different backgrounds. It just let me organize the information so much better than, like, if I were to just invite Kate over and look at my basement table plastered with sticky notes and be like, what's going on? So now it's all actually organized and color-coded and labeled, so it all makes sense. So this is a brand new program I've never used before the other day that I'm starting to roll into now.
Are you familiar with Miro?
I am not.
We use that, and it's the same thing, and I love it. It's basically online whiteboarding, and it's... Yeah, it's the future.
So two products, Lucid Spark or Miro. We can put those in the show notes. Love both of those. All right, Eric,
tip. I've got one more product for Nathan and all of the other shower thinkers out there.
Oh, no.
I bought a...
Waterproof sticky notes?
A $6 scuba diving slate. So it's just a little slate and a pencil, waterproof. I just have it hung on the, like, the shower curtain. And any idea that you have, you can just write it down. They wipe right off with, like, a, magic eraser kind of thing. Not water. So get yourself one of those.
I love that. And that would also work for those of us that wake up in the middle of the night with ideas and we also have to write down. And although 90% of the time when I wake up in the morning, I look at the idea like it was a terrible idea. Yep. But anyway.
I can't even read it. I try and write in the dark.
Yeah, right? All right, Andrea, what are you learning well now?
Yeah, I feel like this doesn't feel as important as that, but I got into bike riding, cycling last summer. And so I've been trying to kind of get my fitness level up for cycling for the summer when I want to do more longer distance rides, but also reading just a lot about cycling because I feel like it very much is like almost like a, it's a whole community and there's all this information out there and I feel like there's so much to learn and just things that being a newbie, it feels a little bit overwhelming. So I'm trying to learn more about that. And I also, I got on the whole home bike bandwagon and I have a bike I cycle on at home as well. So which has badging components to it too, which is super cool. I was thinking about gamifying it. You get badges for certain streaks and different types of rides that you complete. So that's super cool. So that's kind of what I've been learning more about lately.
I love that. You know, that's a big, especially spring rolls around in Michigan.
Yeah.
that we all sort of, whether it's plants or biking or whatever, we can finally get back outside. Jeff, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, because you're joined our game conversation, so what are you learning well now?
Oh, man. I think I'm the king of, like, YouTube rabbit holes. I'll stay up all night. So I think last night I was up till 1 a.m. watching music production stuff.
Oh, interesting.
Because I like to play a lot of music, but I just, you know, you can spend the rest of your life learning about that kind of stuff. So I was just kind of getting lost in tutorials and speeches on that.
Are you
a lot of smart people online?
I was going to say, are you able to find, like, I think it's a skill to teach the younger generation, so to speak, but sort of get your way through the rabbit hole to find who the real experts are.
Yeah. Yeah. And eventually you might attach to one person that you know is good. And then maybe you just kind of go down their videos and start to learn how they do it. And then that's kind of how I like to learn, and just by example. And they'll just do live tutorials on the software you're using, and I can just follow along right next to it. And internet makes it so easy.
Super helpful. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you all so much for joining this podcast. I really appreciate it. And thank you to our listeners. We know your time is very valuable, and we appreciate it. We appreciate you sharing it with us. As always, you know, if you like what you're hearing here, feel free to engage us on social media and to like and download our podcasts.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.